Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, The Pilgrim's Way. Pope Benedict greets a group of cyclists who've just travelled the ancient Via Francigena from Canterbury to Rome. And seeds of hope in Afghanistan. We find out how international aid programs are helping build a sustainable future for families in the war-torn nation. Welcome to the program. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday greeted pilgrims and visitors from across the globe at his regular Angelus address. Speaking from his summer residence at Castel Gandolfo, the Pope reflected on this Sunday's Gospel reading before welcoming a group of religious leaders from Kazakhstan and a group of cyclists who had just completed a pilgrimage from Canterbury to Rome. Here's my colleague Charles Collins with all the details of what the Pope had to say.
In Sunday's Angelus, Pope Benedict spoke about the perplexing passage from Holy Scriptures quoted in this Sunday's liturgy, when Jesus said, "Strive to enter through the narrow gate, for many, I tell you, will attempt to enter, but will not be strong enough."
Non ci sono privilegiati. Il passaggio alla vita eterna è aperto a tutti.
The Holy Father says in Christianity there are not privileged gateways and that the gateway to eternal life is open to all, but is narrow because it's demanding. He said Christians must imitate Mary, the Mother of God, who is humble of heart and is called the Gate of Heaven. After the Angelus, the Pope addressed a group of Muslim, Orthodox, Lutheran, and Catholic religious leaders from Kazakhstan, who following meetings in Padua and Assisi will visit the Vatican.
To the Muslim, Orthodox, Lutheran, and Catholic religious leaders from Kazakhstan present today's Angelus, I wish to extend warm greetings. Your gathering in Assisi and in Padua, together with your meetings in the Vatican, are a sure sign of the hope that mutual understanding and respect between religious communities can overcome distrust and promotes the way of peace which springs from truth. Be assured of my prayers for the success of your visit, and may your efforts bear much fruit for the noble land of Kazakhstan and beyond. Thank you.
The Holy Father also greeted the Canterbury bicycle pilgrimage.
I welcome the participants in the cycling pilgrimage from Canterbury Cathedral to Rome. You have cycled the traditional Via Francigena, following in the footsteps of the many men and women of faith on their way to the tombs of Peter and Paul. I pray that your visit will be a time of spiritual and ecumenical enrichment. May Christ keep you and your families in his love.
My thanks there to Charles Collins for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address. A time of profound spiritual enrichment, but also a time of severe physical challenges. That's how one of the organisers of that pilgrimage from Canterbury to Rome describes the two-week journey along the ancient Via Francigena, first recorded in the writings of the 10th century Archbishop of Canterbury, Sigeric, on his way back from a visit to the Pope.
The Via Francigena is the ancient Frankish way from Rome to Northern Europe. It was a route of trade, a route of commerce, and a route of travel and pilgrimage as well. And in the last 10 years or so, it's being recreated.
Canon Edward Condrey is treasurer at Canterbury Cathedral and a cycling enthusiast. He, his wife Sarah, and his 16-year-old son Jerome were among the 33 intrepid pilgrims who made the journey to raise some much-needed funds for restoration work on the ancient Canterbury Cathedral. The pilgrimage ended on Sunday with Vespers in St. Peter's Basilica. But just before they headed back to Britain, I caught up with Edward to find out more about this journey.
It was a small group of us who've been cycling friends for some time, looked for the next challenge, and I suggested Rome and in Canterbury, and to my surprise everyone said yes, and There's been an enormous number of people wanted to do it, and in fact I've turned people away and said, no, we can't cope with any more, we can't get enough hotel rooms, and we'll block all the roads between Rome and Canterbury.
So the main idea was to raise money, or was it more of a cycling challenge, as you say?
I think the original idea was a physical adventure, but because it was Rome and Canterbury, it then became for some a spiritual pilgrimage as well. It's a very typical model of how pilgrimages work. People go for all kinds of different motives. Some have spiritual reasons, some physical challenge, but my experience of pilgrimage is that everybody who goes in some ways feels changed, whether they are explicitly Christian or not. The experience itself is very significant for them.
And how about the makeup of your group? Were you all Anglican? Were you a mixture of Christian denominations, people of no faith even?
A mixture and people of no faith. One Roman Catholic girl, majority I suppose Anglicans, and quite a lot who don't go to church, and one or two are very anti-church, in fact. And we all went along. I think the best thing about the journey was that the 33 people who completed it, including the six supporters, just worked together in a very diverse range of people. There was a judge, the chief executive of the city council in Canterbury, teachers, someone who works on a boat that goes out of a port in Kent, five school students, someone who's retired. The youngest was 16, the oldest 66, and yet somehow, wonderfully, everyone got along together and worked together, and all the diverse gifts worked together and made something much, much bigger out of it.
There must have been problems along the way, though, weren't there? Personality clashes, perhaps. Tell us about some of the downsides.
There were some. I mean, particularly at the beginning, people inevitably, when they get tired, physically tired, get grumpy with each other, and I got as grumpy as anybody. But that's all part of sorting each other out. And I think one of the most important things about pilgrimage is that you, when you go away, whether you go on a holiday or on a pilgrimage, that the one thing you take with you is yourself. And you can't escape that, inevitably, because you're there, and somehow it strips that away. And being with such a good group and such a big group, you come to see other people accepting you for what you are, because they get to know you. You can't hide anymore behind the facade. And I think it's particularly good for a priest to kind of realise that you can't pretend that you're the kind of perfect person you wish you were, that people realise how imperfect you are and that you do lose your temper and get uptight at inappropriate moments, but they still get on with it and they still accept you and they still want to be with you and you enjoy their company, and that's been great.
What about the spiritual side of it? As you say, a diverse group, some people with no faith, some people very much seeing this as a spiritual pilgrimage. Were there moments of prayer along the way, for example?
Oh, yes. As a group, I offered prayer and a communion service as well, and I suppose about half the group came to that. But also along the way, people welcomed us into their churches in Aulla in northern Italy. The local priest had written a prayer for us in Italian, had it translated into English, and welcomed us into his church and said his prayer and gave us his blessing. The abbot of St. Maurice in Switzerland gave us a late night tour in the dark, which was just wonderful. And again, those of faith and no faith all commented on what an important moments those things were. But I think there's a danger also that you distinguish between what is faith and not faith and what is holy and secular. That one of the most holy and sacred things, in a way, the special thing, was the fact that a group of people ordinary people achieve something extraordinary, because we're not all athletes. Two or three of us were athletes, but good cyclists, but the rest of us were just ordinary people who enjoyed doing something. And that extraordinary thing is of a group working together is actually very holy to me. It speaks of God.
Tell us a bit more about some of the main highlights, if you like, along the way. You mentioned a couple of obviously very moving moments. What perhaps were the most interesting things for you along this route?
It was a tremendous challenge, and therefore, for example, getting to the top of the St. Bernard Pass, which is the route of the Via Francigena, which was the route we were following. I think it's 2,200 metres high, and that was a tremendous challenge, and everybody made it. And I think at the beginning, at breakfast that morning, one or two people looked as though they were about to face the guillotine. They didn't actually think they'd make it to the top, but everyone did. And again, people were working together. And so when one person was in trouble, people stayed with them and helped them up and got them to the top.
This route can only be done at certain times of the year, can't it, because of that pass across the Alps?
Yes, the Via Francigena is the ancient Frankish way from Rome to Northern Europe. It was a route of trade, a route of commerce, and a route of travel and pilgrimage as well. And in the last 10 years or so, it's being recreated, which is wonderful. And increasing numbers are travelling the route from Canterbury to Rome and Rome to Canterbury. And it, the route we know about because the Archbishop of Canterbury in 990, Sigeric, travelled that route and recorded on his way back from Rome to see the Pope, recorded that I think the 80 places where he stopped overnight. So we know precisely the route that he took. And so now it's followed again. And unfortunately for cyclists and walkers, he went over the Grand St Bernard. He wasn't sensible and went down the Rhone Valley and went round the coast, which would have been a lot easier. But it was just wonderful.
Is it something you'd do again?
A pilgrimage and a physical challenge. Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, some crazy people are talking of going from Rome to Canterbury next year, but I'm not sure. But we'll find something else to do, because it was such a good experience as a group to do together.
When we think of pilgrimage, of course, we think back to Chaucer and his Canterbury Tales. Are any of you likely to publish your memoirs of this extraordinary adventure together?
I don't think so much publish. I think the Canterbury Tales, which was a tale of Chaucer's, the great early English writer who told the tales of a group of diverse people travelling along the way, telling their stories. And that's really what's happened, that we've all got to know each other in a way that you would never normally get to know each other in normal life, because you've had to live with each other in quite extreme physical circumstances, because people do get very tired, exhausted. But we've listened to each other's stories in the way that Chaucer wrote about. Also, I think, in the way that Jesus did in the end of Luke's Gospel, on the way to Emmaus, that when he came across the sad disciples, devastated disciples, after the crucifixion, walking away from Jerusalem, he first of all listened to their stories. He didn't try to talk to them about himself or try to convert them. Or his mission, his purpose, his way of evangelizing was actually to listen to the people and what they had to say first, even when they didn't recognize him. And that's very much what's happened here and been my experience on other pilgrimages as well.
There's a very practical side to all this as well. You've raised a lot of money, haven't you, for Canterbury Cathedral and the repairs that are so necessary there?
Yes, I mean, in the UK there's no government money for, no taxes that go towards church finance, whether for charitable work or for restoration. So the bill is £50 million, which is vast. And we've raised about £110,000, I think.
In sponsorship,
of which about 30 will go also to other charities, both local and national charities, like local hospices for the dying, as well as international charities like the UK charity Christian Aid.
So it's been a very worthwhile mission.
Oh,
in this
it's been
sense
wonderful.
As well.
Yes, yeah. Along the way, we've eaten, I think, 1,500 bananas and 600 loaves of bread and 600 bowls of pasta and 40 very large fruitcakes cooked by members of the cathedral congregation, which was just brilliant. And the support team have been fantastic. We had six people along with us who just looked after us fantastically all the way.
A real team effort.
It was. I mean, it really was. And what was so brilliant was it was such a diverse group of people that if I'd said at the beginning I would choose the people I would go with, I would have chosen people like me because, you know, all friends and who I knew. I didn't know all these people. And yet somehow, wonderfully, they all got together and all contributed, whether it was the ability to cook, the ability to mend bicycles, the ability to find the way, the ability to organise the finance. Just everybody contributed what they had. That was fantastic, and actually I think very holy in its way.
My thanks there to Canon Edward Condrey, Treasurer at Canterbury Cathedral and one of the organisers of the pilgrimage from Canterbury to Rome along the Via Francigena. A nation struggling to recover from nearly three decades of conflict and anarchy. A government striving to rebuild basic infrastructures and establish trust amongst former warring parties. A people hoping against all odds that a new era of peace and prosperity is finally on the way. Welcome to Afghanistan Today, a country which still makes news headlines with suicide bombings, hostage takings, and an ongoing refugee crisis. Yet further away from the media spotlight, it's also a nation where international aid is helping to rebuild essential services, where small businesses are beginning to thrive, and where people are at last starting to see a brighter future for their children.
As we were driving out of Herat again, when we were driving out along the dusty roads there, you could see the children going to school, a mix of young girls as much as young boys. This is a key step, and it was very symbolic to see that this was beginning to happen again.
My colleague Paul Antham has recently returned from a visit to the Afghan capital, Kabul, and to the central regions of Bamyan and Herat. He was travelling with a team from the UN's Rome-based Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, to find out more about two projects to improve seed production for local farmers and to build a sustainable seed policy at national level. Despite the devastation of so many years of civil war, Paul found that such projects really are beginning to help local communities get back on their feet again.
That's right. It's been obviously years of war and anarchy have wreaked havoc, basically, with the Afghan civil service. Looters have stripped government laboratories and offices of equipment and records. The public sector ceased to perform its proper function of introducing proper crops, particularly the staple wheat that suffered, but also rice and maize and vegetables. Now, the European Union has financed two FAO projects. The first one is to improve the seed production and then to build a national industry with a seed policy, seed law and proper bodies so that the people are actually getting proper seed so they can grow better crops and then be able to export crops, be able to make more money and be able to, of course, feed their own families. Now, what they're trying to do is set up small entrepreneurial businesses using local villagers to actually run those businesses. Now, one of the founders of these businesses that we met was Abdul Qadir, and he was a typical example. He was a village farmer turned entrepreneur and director of a small seed enterprise. Now, he worked with 18 other villagers who are all founding shareholders in a small business, a small private seed company. And their product is improved quality wheat and vegetable seed. And that's been in great demand amongst the local villagers. So the whole aim of the projects is to encourage local villagers to set up their own businesses, to give them the means to do this, so that they then have the means to sell the seed to the farmers themselves, and then they become self-sufficient, so that when these projects end and when FAO and the other organisations leave Afghanistan, we have a thriving private sector, and that private sector is able to sustain the agriculture industry, not just revitalise it now, but sustain it well into the future.
Paul and the FAO team spoke with farmers in remote villages, several of whom had seen their homes and livelihoods destroyed, first by Soviet troops fighting the Mujahideen militants, then later by the Taliban's rule of terror and violence. Now, however, they're reaping the benefits of these new projects to boost seed production and revive the agricultural sector, one of the keys to improving Afghanistan's struggling economy.
Yes, let me tell you about one wheat grower that we met called Abdul Hamid. Abdul had been provided with a batch of seed initially, his initial part of the project, to see how this seed would grow. Now, the results for him were significant. He enjoyed almost a doubling of the yield of wheat that he had. And with the extra money, he was able to buy extra fruit, extra vegetables. He was also able to bake better bread, which was tastier. And he was also able to buy products such as rice, which obviously is important to farmers like Abdul because it stores better during the winter.
So he said, now we are getting more foods. Before we were traditional, where we were eating some sort of food that were local. We were not, for example, eating rice. Now we are selling this, we are bringing rice, we are bringing other food that we use it. Before we were not using these kind of foods.
These agricultural developments also have a direct impact on Abdul's wife and seven children, who can enjoy a healthier and more diverse diet. Though the horrors and hardships of the past decades can still be clearly seen in wrecked tanks and trucks, the numbers of landmine victims or the many bereaved families, Paul told me there is a new sense of hope slowly taking root in the country.
There have been improvements since the fall of the Taliban in 2001, For many farmers, there are still problems. There are problems with the land. There are problems, obviously, there's climatic problems as well, ongoing drought, and on occasions there are floods as well. So there are climatic problems as well as the conflict problems. We have to remember there's been 30 years of conflict here, and 30 years often when the roads were blocked, the roads were insecure, vehicles were not able to get through, crops could not be exported. So people were not able to make a lot of money. This has obviously impacted on families who have not been able to get to market, not been able to afford even the kind of foods that they would want. So actually by making extra money through these better crops, they're able to diversify, as you rightly say, their diet, they're able to get to the market, they're able to get fruit, extra vegetables. It's all about sustainability and being able to maintain this well into the future.
We read in the papers, though, that there's still a real problem with security throughout Afghanistan. Difficulties, fears of kidnappings, fears of attacks on roads, perhaps going to markets and so on. Did you see anything of this during your trip?
The security situation has improved a lot. In the areas that we were in, we did not see a massive security problem. Let me say, in the areas such as Kabul and the capital, if administration level, if I was trying to arrange a meeting, that would need full protection. You would have to have a proper organised protection, proper notice to the appropriate authorities. In terms of actually FAO and the UN trying to do its work, it's quite well accepted. I think it's appreciated in the work that it's trying to do. For people actually trying to get to the markets now, as I say, under the Taliban rule and previous to that, during the Soviet invasion, there was certainly the roads were a lot more difficult to negotiate. A lot of roads were blocked off. Trucks could not get through. People were having to walk maybe 20, 30 kilometres to get to market. We're not seeing those problems now. And in that area, there's definitely been improvement.
Do people still fear that the Taliban may gain ground again? We hear reports of them regrouping, perhaps trying to stage another comeback in some way.
I think people in Afghanistan are quietly optimistic, and I think they are an optimistic people. They're very positive people. They're very positive in terms of if they're given the conditions actually to make a living and to farm their land and to live in peace, then that is something that they embrace. And one of the main things that we found was we could harness that in terms of actually encouraging these people to go into the private industries, to actually try something new, to actually invest money, and also the people to buy seeds directly from the private or from the private enterprises. This was something that people were very, very keen to do because they do have this positive element, this positive outlook, which they've had to have really through 30 years of conflict. They've had to sustain that attitude to be able to sustain themselves, that they've had to be very resilient to a situation where, as I say, the roads were often blocked. Often the land could not be farmed. So I would say, One of the technical staff of the government told me that the Afghani people are very prone to change. They'll harness opportunities that they're given. You know, they're growing wheat, for example, but the wheat does not grow so well. So now with this new seed, you can introduce higher quality seed, more disease tolerant seed. And if they're given a chance to try different types of seed and different types of crop even, they'll take it. Yeah, and they'll try something new. And basically, it's not a case of like feeling about the Taliban and what's going to happen. It's being able to make a living, and it's being able to make the most of the conditions that they're in, and then quietly hoping that this is not interrupted by anything further and any other factors outside that.
Those who suffered most under the Taliban, of course, were the women, who were virtually excluded from education, from public life, from any participation in social life as well. How are they doing today? You mentioned a couple of men you met. You also met some of the women, though, didn't you?
We did, and there has been a dramatic improvement in that area. And we actually, under the FAO project, in some of the seed testing laboratories, we actually have some women employed in those areas now who are playing a major part in helping to revive Afghanistan's agriculture. Obviously, under the Taliban regime, the women suffered maybe most of all. We're talking now between about 1996 and 2001. Conditions in which women were forbidden to work, they could not attend school beyond the age of 8 years, and on cases could not even leave home without a male escort. Now, we interviewed some women in a laboratory in Herat, a seed test laboratory. For example, Nazila Jamshidi, who was a good example. For her, she was like the sole breadwinner in her house. So despite the fact that there might be this cultural concern, there might be cultural pressures, she explained to me that there was nobody else in her house to make money. Her father had died, when she was two during conflict. Her mother was ill now and got migraines, and she was the only person who could actually bring in an income. So regardless of what the cultural pressures were, not that she received any cultural pressures herself, but regardless of if there were those kind of pressures, a lot of women have no choice. They have to work.
She says it's very important because what she gets is 150 Afghanis from here. And this can be the food and other expenses for her family.
And how can she spend that money?
She uses this money for the rice, for the oil, and for clothing, and sweets, tea and this.
Another woman was telling me at the laboratory that there is social pressure from her not necessarily from her family, but from her neighbours, and she senses a general distaste for the fact that she is a woman and she's working, and this may be against some people's beliefs and some people's culture. At the same time, she had to work. She was the only one who's bringing money into that family. She's the only one who can help sustain that family. So it's not a matter of choice. But I found with the majority of women in the Herat area who we spoke to, there was a general acceptance that women were working. Obviously, that's not true in all areas, but I think increasingly, and particularly when we look at like a zone that has had conflict for 30 years, the role of women is going to be very important because they are often left as the only breadwinner or one of the only breadwinners.
Women are, of course, or young girls rather, are going to school again, aren't they? There are hopes that this social status, these pressures that you're talking about, this will change slowly, won't it?
Absolutely. And as we were driving out of Herat again, when we were driving out along the dusty roads there, you could see the children going to school, a mix of young girls as much as young boys. And obviously this was, for me, was like very symbolic in terms of like the problems that Afghanistan has been through and the lack of skills and the lack of training. Because just to be clear, during the conflict, a vast majority of skilled technicians, of skilled engineers, of skilled people in agriculture and in other fields either were forced to flee the country or were killed. Now, that's left a massive gap in skills and knowledge. And the fact is that this is a very worrying sign for Afghanistan. And now we're seeing like a period of retraining, of re-education. Now, that starts with the fact that FAO is in doing these projects, and FAO is able to give technical advice to trainees now, for example, in agricultural techniques, in computer use, in use of internet and so on. But was also symbolised for me that it starts right at the beginning. So when you see these children actually going to school now, getting a basic education, like basic literacy, basic knowledge like this, this is a key step. And it was very symbolic to see that this was beginning to happen again. And as much with girls as with boys.
And my thanks there to Paul Anthem, recently returned from Afghanistan on a field trip organised by the United Nations Rome-based Food and Agriculture Organisation. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at the same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.